Well, turn again then, please, to Genesis chapter 4, verses 16 to 26. Now, you know how it is when you're watching a film, and if the film is based on a true story, then quite often, right at the end, just before the credits appear, some script will appear on the screen, kind of taking you beyond the events which have been depicted in the film itself. So it might be telling you what happened afterwards to the main characters, or it might be telling you the wider historical significance of the story that you have just been watching. That kind of thing. It's tying up loose ends. It's answering those concluding questions which might be there in the mind of the viewer. And in many ways, this passage that we're looking at this morning fulfills a similar role. In the first part of chapter 4, we have watched this compelling story unfold. We have watched these two brothers, Cain and Abel, bring their respective offerings to God, one of them accepted, the other one rejected. And we have watched then Cain escort his brother Abel out into a lonely field and there brutally murder him. And we have watched then God place this remarkable preservation order upon Cain, ensuring that no one will be able to kill Cain in some kind of revenge attack. And so that then, in those first 15 verses, is the main body of the story. That's the dramatic bit. That's the suspense-filled bit. That, if you like, is the cinematic bit. And what we have now in verses 16 to 26 is like that script that comes up at the end of the film. It's the tying up of loose ends. It's answering those concluding questions that might well be there in the reader's mind. And two such questions in particular, I think, are answered in this passage. And I just want to look at each in turn, but the first one will take much, much longer than the second one. So, the first question then that we see being answered in this passage. What happened to Cain afterwards? What happened to Cain afterwards? Did Cain then go on from the events we were looking at last week and sell his story to the tabloid newspapers? Did he go on from those events and become some kind of guru taking anger management classes? What happened to Cain? Well, the answer that we're told in this passage is that Cain went on to found a civilization. That's what Cain did. Post the events of those dramatic first 15 verses, Cain went on to found a civilization. And two things stand out about this civilization which Cain founded. First of all, it's a godless civilization. We mustn't miss that telling comment that we have at the start of our passage in verse 16. So Cain went out from the Lord's presence and lived in the land of Nod, east of Eden. And that, you see, is the all-important backdrop then to everything that is now going to take place. As Cain sets about founding this civilization, he does so, we are being told here, outside of the presence of God. Now, let's not get philosophical about that and start asking, yes, but isn't God's presence everywhere? Surely you can't step out of the presence of God. That's not the point. The point here is that this civilization did not emerge in a context of communion with and dependence upon God. This civilization here emerged in a context of ignorance of and flight from God. This was a worldly, secular, man-centered civilization. So that's the first thing that stands out about it. The second thing that stands out about it is that it's an impressive civilization. It's an impressive civilization. Just look at its achievements. First of all, city building. Verse 17, Cain lay with his wife and she became pregnant and gave birth to Enoch. Cain was then building a city and he named it after his son Enoch. Now, those of you who are lovers of the countryside may not think that building the first city here is much of an achievement, not something really to boast about. And I have some sympathy with that. When we were on our way back from the northwest of Scotland recently, we stopped off at Inverness. And Inverness may not suggest to you a sprawling metropolis, but to us, after the remoteness of where we'd been with the single-track roads and the spacious beaches and everything, it just seemed utterly overwhelming, all these cars and all these street lamps and all these shops and all these people. And so, as I say, I have some sympathy with you if you find Keynes building a city here something of a turn-off. But we've got to remember that city here doesn't have its modern associations. We're not talking about something big. Keynes' project wasn't on the scale of 21st century London, or even 21st century Newcastle, or even 21st century Inverness, for that matter. Presumably, Keynes was building for the future. He had in mind, presumably, his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren as he built this city. But even so, it was probably, in our modern terms, more of a village than a city. We're talking here about something fairly small. But the point is, you see, that Cain understood the value and importance of human beings living together in a community, in a close-knit settlement. He understood that that way resources can be pooled and knowledge can be shared and defenses can be strengthened. And that's why, then, I say this was a stroke of genius on Cain's part. Not because he developed some kind of concrete jungle here, but because he developed an efficient, functioning human community. So that's one achievement. Then another achievement, we have livestock farming. Go down to verse 20. Now we've moved on a few generations here, but of course moving on a few generations in this context isn't such a meaningful concept as it is for us now, because people were living so long. Cain was almost certainly still around as these descendants of his were living their lives. And we read then in verse 20 that Adar gave birth to Jabal. He was the first of those who live in tents and raise livestock. Now, of course, Abel, before this, had farmed animals. But the word that is used in connection with Abel earlier on in the chapter is the word flocks, and that can only really apply to sheep and goats. Whereas the word that is used now in connection with this guy, Jabal, it's here in the NIV livestock, but it's literally herds. And it can apply and does usually apply to a much broader range of animals, to cattle and asses and camels. Animals, in other words, that aren't necessarily for eating, but for carrying people and for carrying things. And that's why then this was such a striking achievement. Because what we're looking at here is effectively the beginning of transport here with this man, Jabal. Then another achievement, we have musical instruments. The next verse, verse 21, his brother's name was Jubal. He was the father of all who play the harp and flute. So that's pretty self-explanatory then. As is the next achievement that we're told of. We're told of metalwork, aren't we? In the next verse, Zillah also had a son, Tubal-Cain, who forged all kinds of tools out of bronze and iron. And so I'm saying then that we have an impressive list here. We have city building, we have livestock farming, we have musical instruments, we have metalwork, and these are notable achievements. They speak of a real flowering, a real blossoming of culture and technology. So we've got then this civilization which Cain founded. Here he is, this man we looked at last week, this man who murdered his brother, this man whom God remarkably said wasn't to be killed in a revenge attack. And here we have him now moving on from there, founding this civilization, and two things stand out about it. It's godless and it's impressive. And I just want to draw three lines of application from this. First of all, God often graciously ensures that his commands are obeyed unwittingly. I'll say it again. God often graciously ensures that his commands are obeyed unwittingly. Because what's going on here in these verses if not exactly what God himself had commanded back in chapter 1, verse 28. There we read, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it. Subdue the earth. And when we were looking at that, you may remember we said God is there commanding man then to harness the creation's full potential, to get the most out of the creation, to identify and make good use of all its resources. And isn't that exactly what we see going on now here in chapter 4? Cain and Jabel and Jubal and Tubal-Cain, they are busy subduing the earth. They are busy as managers and stewards of the creation, which is exactly what God had commanded men to be. And yet, you see, this is the interesting thing. They're not doing so because God had commanded it. Cain certainly would have been aware of the command. He'd have been aware of it through his father Adam, wouldn't he? But it's highly unlikely, I think, that that command was in the forefront of his mind as he started building this city here. And as for his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren, well, they had probably never heard at all of that command back in chapter 1, verse 28. And so these men, you see, they had no concept of man as this kingly, image-bearing representative of the divine monarch himself. That just wasn't on their radar. And yet, to a certain degree, they are fulfilling that role anyway. And I'm saying that's God's grace. It's God's grace that men had that unbelieving men had the impulse to build cities. Because otherwise, the miserable idea of every man his own island would have taken root. And it's God's grace that unbelieving men had the impulse to breed animals as beasts of burden. Because otherwise, man's only means of transport would have remained his own two legs. And it's God's grace that unbelieving men had the impulse to make musical instruments. Because otherwise, the human ear would have been denied beautiful and enchanting and enriching sounds. And it's God's grace that unbelieving men had the impulse to develop metalwork, because otherwise human beings would have been denied all kinds of helpful technological props for living their lives in this world. And similarly then, it's God's grace that unbelieving human beings, unbelieving men have had all kinds of other impulses throughout the centuries, right up until this very day, which have kept the wheels of science and art and industry turning. You see, if man had for one moment abdicated his God-given responsibility altogether, his God-given responsibility to rule a creation, to use constructively the resources at his disposal, if he'd abdicated that altogether, well, what a sad race we would have become living on this planet, wouldn't we? But God hasn't allowed that to happen. He has ensured that throughout the centuries, from Cain's day to our day, unbelieving men and women have had the impulses to be precisely the managers and stewards of the creation which he first commanded us to be. And we see the same thing in other areas, don't we? You think of God's marriage commands. Now, we're very aware, of course, that many people today don't take marriage seriously. But it's also true, of course, that many people do. That still today there are many people who aren't Christians, they aren't believers in Jesus Christ, and yet they marry one person of the opposite sex and they stay married to that person throughout their lives. And again, that's God's grace, isn't it? It's God's grace that unbelieving men and women have the impulse to commit themselves to one another and to raise children in that stable environment, because if it were not the case, then our society would just disintegrate. It would fall apart. It would collapse. And unruly teenagers with antisocial behavior wouldn't just be a problem. It would be the norm. And yet, you see, God hasn't allowed that to happen. He has continued to plant this impulse within men and women. Men and women who have no sense of a divine obligation, who have no sense that their marriage is reflecting the greater marriage between Jesus Christ and his church. And yet, to a degree, they are fulfilling that, their marriages are fulfilling that role anyway. Or you think of God's commands concerning the sanctity of life. And again, we're very aware that in some areas, the sanctity of life is disregarded appallingly when it comes to abortion, when it comes to embryo research and those kind of areas. But in other areas, of course, the sanctity of life is taken seriously. So that when there's a 999 call, because someone has been hurt and injured, someone is dying perhaps, the response doesn't come back, sorry, the emergency services aren't working today, nothing we can do about it, I'm the day off. Never that response. But always, within seconds, ambulances, fire engines are racing down the roads. And again, you see, those firemen, those paramedics, if they're not believers in Jesus Christ, they have no sense of divine obligation. No sense that that injured, dying person they are going to is someone made in the image of God. And yet, to an extent, they're acting as though that were the case anyway. It's God's grace. Because again, if it were not the case, if unbelieving men and women didn't have that impulse to save lives and to keep hearts beating and keep lungs functioning, then our society would again just fall apart. It would disintegrate. Because you can't carry on where the loss of a human life is no different to the loss of a spider's life. But God hasn't allowed that to happen. And so I'm saying then, this is the grace of God. The same grace that we saw back at the end of chapter 3 provided fallen men with clothing and with the continuation of human births. This same God who we saw there was so gracious in the aftermath of the fall, we're seeing it again here. This God who doesn't allow our human societies to become hell on earth, but who ensures that some of his commands at least, perhaps not many of them, but some of his commands at least, for the good of the planet, are obeyed unwittingly. What a gracious and merciful God we have. Second line of application. Cultural and technological development doesn't improve people's morals. Cultural and technological development doesn't improve people's morals. In verses 19 and 24, then, we encounter this man Lamech, don't we? And the first thing that we're told about him in verse 19 is that he married two women. Now, I suppose that if that were all that we were told of Lamech, if that were all that he had done, we might be prepared to give him the benefit of the doubt and say, well, God hadn't explicitly prohibited polygamy, and so perhaps this was just an innocent and well-meaning course of action here, him marrying these two women. But when we read on further, and we find out more about Lamech, and we discover that he was an extremely proud man, a man who was ruthlessly determined to assert himself over every possible rival and challenger, when we read that, we begin to realize, I think, that Lamech's polygamy, like most polygamy since, wasn't the naive but sincere attempt to share his love with more than one woman. It was about conquest. It was about having two women at his beck and call. It was about being able to boast down at the pub on a Friday night of his two wives back at the house. What is it then that leads me to that conclusion? Well, move on down to verse 23, where we read these words. Lamech said to his wives, Adar and Zillah, listen to me. Wives of Lamech, hear my words. I have killed a man for wounding me, a young man for injuring me. We don't know in what way this other person had injured Lamech. We don't know the circumstances, what had gone on. But what is clear is that Lamech had reacted altogether out of proportion. that he had felt his unassailable superiority challenged by this other person who had dared to injure him. And he had reacted, as I say, entirely disproportionately and had murdered this young man. And we read in verse 24 then, if Cain is avenged seven times, then Lamech 77 times. This is a reference, of course, back to verse 15, where we read, if anyone kills Cain, he will suffer vengeance seven times over. What that presumably means is that if someone had killed Cain, then not only would that person have died for what they did, but six of that person's relatives would also have died for what that person had done. And of course, it's God who's making that announcement in verse 15. And only God has the right to do so, doesn't he? Only God has the right to sanction seven deaths on the basis of one murder. Imagine if a state in America that still has the death penalty, imagine if it started saying that from now on, not only does a murderer have to die, but six of the murderer's relatives as well. There'd be outrage, and rightly so. Only God has the right to make that kind of announcement. And yet here you see in verse 24 we have Lamech effectively saying, well, I've got just as much right as God to make these kinds of announcements. In fact, I can go better than God. And if God sanctions seven deaths on the basis of a murder, I can sanction 77 deaths on the basis of a murder. And so I hope you get a feel then for this man Lamech and just what a wicked, evil man we're talking about here. And do you see then that leaves us with a terribly stark contrast at the very heart of this passage? Because on the one hand, you see, we have such progress. Cities are being built. Transport is being developed. Musical instruments are being made. Metalwork is getting off the ground. Progress, progress, progress. And yet on the other hand, we have such wickedness, such evil, such depravity. This man Lamech casting off all restraints and acting like a brute beast. Because you see, the fact is that all this progress and all this advance and all this sophistication had done nothing to change the human heart, which back in chapter 3 had become such a terribly diseased thing. And don't we see the same phenomenon in our own society today? We have microwave ovens and broadband phones and air-conditioned cars. But do we have empty jails? We have keyhole surgery for our hearts, laser treatment for our eyes, epidurals for our childbirths. Do we have streets on which it's safe to walk late at night? We have Wembley Stadium. We have the Millennium Dome. We have a new terminal at Heathrow Airport. But can you find an estate agent that you can trust when you're buying or selling a property? And it's the same thing, isn't it? That we have everything. We have an abundance of culture and technology. We have it coming out of our ears. And yet we also have an abundance of abject moral depravity. And in fact, there's something else actually in this passage. That not only does culture and technology fail to change the human heart, but culture and technology actually becomes hijacked by the evil human heart. Because it's very interesting. Verses 23 and 24, you'll notice in the NIV, are set out a bit differently, aren't they? They're kind of on their own. And the reason for that, then, is because they were most probably a poem or a song. And a very brilliant one at that. It doesn't really come across in the English, but in the Hebrew, the structure, the rhythm, the technique of this poem, this song here in verses 23 and 24, is really quite remarkable. Lamech may not have had much literary imagination when it came to naming his sons Jabal and Jubal, but when it came to poetry and songs, he was quite an artist. And here we have then another example, don't we, of this kind of cultural golden age that is going on here in chapter 4. Lamech with this brilliant new literary genre. But what's he doing with it? He's boasting about a violent murder that he's carried out. Just like we have this brilliant thing, the internet. And what do we do with it? We have damaging, addictive, online gambling. We have this brilliant thing, the camera. What do we do with it? We create images of sex and violence. We have this brilliant thing, the jumbo jet. What do we do with it? We deliberately destroy two towers in New York City, killing 3,000 people. And it's the same thing, you see. And why is this? Why is it that with all this cultural and technological development, there isn't a commensurate development in morals? And in fact, why, on the contrary, do culture and technology so often seem to be hijacked to immoral ends? Well, the answer is, you see, that there's only one thing in the world that can change the human heart. Only one thing. And it's the gospel of Jesus Christ. What is the gospel of Jesus Christ? You remember that great summary of it that we have in an indirect way in the angel's words to Joseph, Matthew 1:21, that they were to call the baby's name Jesus. Why? Because he will save his people from their sins. That's the gospel of Jesus Christ. He will save his people from their sins. And we often confine that to just one thing, that Jesus saves from the consequence of our sins. He saves from hell, in other words. And that, of course, is wonderfully true. But that's not what that verse says, is it? It says, he will save his people from their sins. And it means not only the consequence of their sins, it means that he will save his people from actually sinning. Never, of course, completely in this life, but really in this life. The power and dominion of sin is broken in the lives of those whom the gospel of Jesus Christ has touched. And so, you see, you can embrace every cultural and technological development under the sun. You can embrace them all. And externally, you may become very sophisticated and very erudite and very cultured. But inwardly, it will be the same old you, with the same old lusts and the same old flaws and the same old vices. But you see, when you embrace the gospel of Jesus Christ, you become a new person. You become a new creation, as the Apostle Paul puts it, with new powers and new energies, the new ability to say no to ugly patterns of behavior, a new ability to say yes to good and honorable patterns of behavior. And that, you know, is the only hope if our society is ever going to really, lastingly, truly develop morally. If there's going to be true moral renovation, in our society, this is how it's got to happen, through the gospel of Jesus Christ. And indeed, if there's going to be true moral renovation in your life and in my life, this is how it's got to happen, through the gospel of Jesus Christ. It alone can change the human heart. Third line of application. What matters is how we use the things of this world. What matters is how we use the things of this world. You see, we've already said, haven't we, that these things that emerged during the time of this civilization, city building, livestock farming, musical instruments, metalwork, that these were tokens of God's grace. They were enriching human life on this planet. But that perhaps needs reiterating. Because you see, you could argue like this, couldn't you? Well, surely these things, city building, livestock farming, musical instruments, metalwork, well, they emerged in such a sad context. They emerged in that godless civilization of Cain's. They emerged in that civilization dominated by men like Lamech, that civilization outside of the presence of the Lord. Surely then these things must be inherently wrong. Surely there can't be anything good in anything that emerged from that kind of civilization. But that's not the case. And if you want confirmation of that, just look at the way these things emerge later on in the Bible. Take city building, and you think of Jerusalem, the beautiful city of God. Take animals being bred as beasts of burden, none other than our Lord Jesus Christ rode into Jerusalem on a donkey. Take musical instruments. Look at the temple in the Old Testament and the way in which the musical instruments there were used in the worship of God. Take metalwork and again go to the temple and look at the instruments, the tools that were used for the sacrifices made of metal. And you see, in none of those instances did anyone say, well, we can't use these things because these things emerged in Cain's wicked civilization. Because what matters is how we use the things of this world. And that has an enduring application. We can apply it, for instance, to fashionable clothes, can't we? You see, you could easily say, as a Christian, we should shun fashionable clothes because the whole fashion industry is embedded in a secular society. Now, of course, there are dangers in the fashion industry. If clothes are immodest or something like that, then obviously it's wrong. But we can't say it's inherently wrong just because it's embedded in a secular society. Same with rock music. Again, it has its dangers. Like Lamech's genre here, it can be used to express violence and other things as well. But we can't say that it's inherently wrong just because embedded in a secular civilization. Same with investing money on the stock exchange, stocks and shares and the whole economic system. We can't say, it's so embedded in this secular civilization, we must shun it altogether. Again, there are dangers, but it can't be inherently wrong. And so I'm saying then that what matters is how we use the things of this world. That if we are using things discerningly, if we are using things thankfully, giving thanks to God for his good gifts that he has showered upon this fallen world, then there is a legitimacy about using even those things that have been developed by and are embedded in a secular civilization. Well, that's our first question, and what happened to Cain afterwards. Our second question, which I'm only going to spend a couple of minutes on, the second question that is answered in this passage, what happened to God's promise afterwards? What happened to Cain afterwards? What happened to God's promise afterwards? What am I referring to? Well, God's promise, to which we have come back several times throughout this series, that promise in Genesis 3 and verse 15, where God promised that the serpent who had just mucked everything up there in the garden was one day going to be destroyed by the seed of the woman. What happened to that promise? Because at the beginning of chapter 4, we were so encouraged, weren't we? Because there was Abel, and he was so obviously a fulfillment of that promise. He was a man who was clearly the seed of the woman. He was a man who was Godward in the orientation of his life, and who was in conflict indeed with the seed of the serpent, in his case Cain. And we were encouraged then, as we looked at that first half of the chapter, that here was God already implementing the terms of that Genesis 3:15 promise. Already we were seeing it taking shape as Abel, the seed of the woman, took on Cain, the seed of the serpent. But Abel's dead now. Cain's not dead. The seed of the serpent's still going strong, but Abel, the seed of the woman, has gone. What's happened to God's promise? Well, we're told in the last part of the chapter, verse 25, Adam lay with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, God has granted me another child in place of Abel, since Cain killed him. And it's very clear, partly because of the language that Eve uses, it's not actually literally God has granted me another child, it's God has granted me another seed. A definite reference back to Genesis 3:15. So partly because of that, and then partly because of that detail at the end of verse 26, at that time men began to call on the name of the Lord, which probably means that at that time public worship began. That rather than just informal private worship, which had taken place amongst the godly up until that point, public worship, this kind of worship that we're engaged in this morning, was inaugurated. And these things make it pretty clear then, I think, that Seth, he wasn't like Cain. He wasn't part of that crowd. Seth was the continuation of the seed of the woman. Seth was another foreshadowing, tiny foreshadowing, like Abel had been, of the seed of the woman who would ultimately come and conquer the serpent. And it's just fascinating, isn't it? The way in which God goes about fulfilling his purposes here. That at the center stage of the known world at this time, you have this great, glistening, gleaming, sophisticated civilization. You have all this development going on, all this progress, and it's all so exciting, and it's all so busy. And then just at the edge of it all, kind of bypassing it all, you have God fulfilling his redemptive purposes. Just a little footnote at the end of the chapter, and Seth was born, this seed of the woman. And we see God then bypassing this great, bustling, busy civilization, and just quietly in the background getting on with his great redemptive program. A bit like many centuries later, when you had an even bigger and an even busier and an even more sophisticated civilization in this world, the Roman civilization, with all its developments, all its roads, all its aqueducts, all its astonishing inventions and technology. And everything was happening at the heart of that Roman civilization. And yet, to find what was really happening, you had to go to a little backwater called Judea, and to a little town, a little village actually, called Bethlehem, and to a little stable at the end of a garden in Bethlehem. And that's where God was quietly, out of the spotlight, out of the gaze of the world, fulfilling his redemptive purposes and bringing the seed of the woman into the world to finally conquer the serpent's head. And perhaps then, as we conclude, it reminds us that while we should be grateful for all those aspects of our contemporary civilization which are God's gifts, all those technological and cultural developments which enrich our lives, we should be thankful for those and use them gratefully. And we should also, of course, seek to bring the gospel to bear upon the culture around us. We should do all of that. But let's not take too seriously Starbucks and Facebook and the internet and Britney Spears and the Tate Modern and all the other icons of our culture around us. Because we have a God who, at Bethlehem and at Calvary, and indeed in the Christian church generally, has made a habit of bypassing the bustling civilizations of this world. He is the God, Paul tells us, quote in the Old Testament, who destroys the wisdom of the wise and frustrates the intelligence of the intelligent. And so let's, yes, use sensibly and appropriately the different aspects of our culture around us, but let's not be obsessed by them. Let's be obsessed by this God, who in his quiet and yet unstoppable way has and is redeeming the world. Amen.